My name's Laurie McMullen, and I'm the Executive Director of the Canadian Association of Higher Education IT. I'm also on the program committee for this year's EDUCAUSE, and I'm here to welcome you to the session. The featured session this morning, as you're going to hear about, is all about the relationship between the Vice President's Finance and the Vice President's IT, or just the IT and administrative units in our university. So it's going to be an exciting discussion, I'm sure, panel discussion with our esteemed panel members. I'm not going to introduce them all. I'm going to leave that to your moderator, Brian, just in a few seconds. I just have some administrative things. First of all, I want to thank our sponsor, Avast Technology, for sponsoring this session. We are also streaming the session online, so I welcome our online participants as well as the people in the room. So without further ado, I'm going to turn this over to Brian, who's going to take care of the moderation of the session, and there'll be some Q&A after. And the only other last item is don't forget to fill out your feedback forms. Very important for the next program committee. Thanks very much.
Great. Thank you. So the genesis of this session was I have a very good relationship with my CFO at Maryland, and I thought this would be an interesting topic to explore as part of the admin IT. How can we broaden this? And I sent a note out to about 60 of my colleagues, and I said, hey, who's got a really good relationship with their CFO? And, of course, the caveat being not one that you work for, because, of course, we have good relationships with folks like that. But, you know, if you've got one, you identify, I'd like to talk about what we might do for a session. And out of the 62 people I sent to, I got two responses. So that's why this is, in parentheses, you see the uncommon relationship. And so what we want to try and do is look at some success stories of how this relationship works and maybe find out through discussion with our CFO colleagues from their perspective what makes it tick. So let me do the introductions, and again, sort of sticking with the movie themes. We also have their CIOs in the audience. We've stuck them down and said, I'll represent them. So from Duke, we have Tim Walsh and Tracy Futhi, who is his CIO counterpart. I thought that was a really good representation of the two of you. Tim's a little younger than Spencer is there. On Tim's right is Lynn Johnson. She is from Colorado State University, and her CIO colleague is Pat Burns up here in the front. I actually picked this picture when I was going through different couples and saw, you know, Lauren Bacall, and that made me think of Lynn, and I thought that my good friend would enjoy being compared to Bogart, as opposed to he suggested that I should think about Beauty and the Beast a moment ago. And then if it's not a lead-in, I will show you the next picture, which is Rob Spector and I sort of as the Hope and Crosby routine there, and I've taken the Hope line. So I do want to back up a little bit and just tell you that Tim has served Duke for the past decade and worked with research universities across the country for 20 years. His wife is on the faculty of Duke. God love you, Tim. Tim gets abused from many of the administrative failings, both at work and at home. He is serves as, I like this, father and slave to three small children. God, once again, God love you. Each of them has already passed him in terms of technology adoption rates, so that's great. Like Tim, Lynn has logged over a decade of service at her current institution. She, too, pays for the shortcomings of the administrative systems from those in the office, as well as from her two college-age sons, currently attending Colorado State University. By the way, good luck. I hope that you enjoy graduation. I had two boys that attended, and let's just say they completed their mission at their university. As far as her level of technology prowess is concerned relative to theirs, her son suggests that she just give it up. The majority of today's audience being CIOs is probably not a surprise that thus she serves as the CFO of their institution. Rob is a longtime CFO with 19 years as a vice president at a variety of large public research universities, most recently as my colleague and good friend at the University of Maryland. In prior roles, he was responsible for university-wide IT as well, so thus he is a scarred veteran of many an ERP system implementation. His perspective of the CIO-CFO relationship is shaped by a set of diverse experiences, and he also has a very open mind and is very optimistic. And just so I'm going to brag on him for a second before we get into the questions. This is a guy, a CFO, who came to me one day and said, Brian, if I lease you some machine room space and pay for the power, would you go out and buy a supercomputer? I'm like, hello, could you say that again? Who are you? That's the kind of relationship that I think we all would like to have. So let me now walk away from the podium and sit down with my friends and pose for them some questions which I'd like them to respond to and engage in discourse. And I think the first one that I'll bring up is that you all are on this panel because of the relationship that you have with your CIOs and that they felt strongly about that. What has made that pairing in your particular situation work well? So I'm going to start with Tim.
Sure. I think the most important thing is recognition of common priorities. Not that our priorities in our organizations are necessarily aligned, but our bigger priorities in terms of the betterment of Duke are always aligned, as best I can tell. And the way we work through that is together and through a good set of relationships down in our organization. So we have structures that enable the sort of collective thinking of our teams. And Tracy and I spend a lot of time together also. But I don't think it's as much related to organizational structure as it is to personality. I'm a believer that any organizational structure can work with the right people, and any organizational structure will fail with the wrong people. And I think it really comes down to the fact that there is a culture among our teams where we know we have to collaborate to help Duke further towards its missions. And that's what we all commit ourselves to every day.
Okay. Lynn?
I would have to agree with the comments that Tim has made, but what I would add to that is that Pat nor I are the final resource allocation decision makers, and we realize that if we want to make some improvements around our campus, that we're going to have to present collectively together to those individuals in order to make our case. So we feel working together is much more beneficial for us than it would be for either of us to go it alone on these issues.
Rob.
You know, to add a little bit, I could say the same things and agree, but I would say that there's another critical factor in addition to aligned priorities, and that is the recognition of interdependency. The strongest relationships are those where the parties need each other, and the weakest are where they have nothing in common and don't need each other. And there's nothing magical about these particular roles in building a relationship. They have to go through the same effort that every human being has to go through to create a relationship with someone that matters to them. In this case, Brian and his organization are responsible for a good deal of the success or failure potential that my team has. And being the control freak that I am, I like to get close to those things that impact my success or failure potential. And likewise, I would like to think that I have certain influence and certain opportunities to advocate on behalf of information technology that Brian recognizes as valuable. So we see right from the get-go, before we even got to know each other, that our roles needed to be close to each other. And then after that, it became simply important for us to develop a personal relationship.
So you're all kind of here because your CIO said that you grasp their role very well and understand there's a lot of empathy and understanding. Turn that around and describe, I guess, how you feel the importance of how well Tracy or Pat or I understand what your role is about. So that sort of converts why it's important that CIOs and CFOs, CIOs grok your portfolio. Lynn, would you start with that?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for putting Lauren Bacall up there and assimilating me to her. I actually, when I thought about the relationships, I kind of likened Pat and I to Lucy and Desi.
That was second choice.
And Pat has a lot of splaining to do most of the time. So, no, actually, I think Pat does a great job of understanding where I'm coming from in my role and the role that I play at the university. most of the projects that we do together as a team, and we're usually working together to rope in the others to come along with us. And I think Pat understands that and appreciates that we do need to do that together and appreciates the role that I play in that.
Rob?
Well, there are probably too many illustrations of this to articulate here in this panel, but when you and I first sat down and we really began to kind of talk through the areas where we had things in common, we found were numerous, and among them were the ways that we felt we needed to bring about change in our organizations as newcomers to the university. And so we immediately found common ground and found things to share with each other. I was not astounded, but very pleased that you had as strong a sense as you have of not only the technical aspects of the finance organization, but recognized some of the organizational and personnel challenges that I faced as I came in. I think it also helped that we came in at about the same time.
Yeah, that was a point, before I let Tim chime in on this too. So you and I started a month apart, and given what I know of the, I mean, what's the differential, Lim, you and Pat? I mean, who was there first, or did you also come in at about the same time?
I don't know the answer to that. Pat was at CSU long before I was. He was on our faculty and has moved into the role that he's been in, and I've come in through sponsor programs and controller role. And Pat, how many years have you been there?
36.
Yeah,
he's doubled my years by far.
Well, yeah, that kind of goes, doesn't it? So Tim, what's your perspective of Tracy's grasp of the challenges that you face as CFO?
It's very, very solid, and I think you mentioned the common ground between the CFO and the CIO in terms of getting things done. There's countless occasions where we have had the same perspectives and the same vision for where we needed to go. And what stunned me as I thought about this discussion was how few times there's actually been a significant disconnect between our visions for where we wanted to go. But I think that goes back to the fact that we work together so often and our teams know each other so well. If we didn't understand each other's direction, it'd be very hard to find that common ground sometime. But the fact that we do know each other and know each other's organizations well, it's like we almost intuitively know where the other's going to be going, and we tend to steer in that direction just by instinct as much as anything. So we always seem to end up in the right place together. And when we do have disconnects, I think there's a level of trust that creates the kind of discussion that you need to get through it and find that common ground again to get to the final solution. Yeah.
So, I mean, we do have these good relationships, and that's great. Great for us. Have a cookie, right? Yeah. But what can you give advice to the CIOs that are in the audience today about, what's important to you? What's the most pressing needs in your areas? Because I think, and Rob mentioned this in sort of our preliminary discussion, that misalignment of thinking that leads to poor relationships often comes from just not understanding what your priorities are. So maybe if you all could take a minute to share from your perspectives what the priorities are. And Rob, I'm going to start with you in this case.
Well, there is a need by both vice presidents, both camps, to focus on operations just because we have operations. And you can have priorities and goals and all kinds of things, but if the trains aren't running on time, there's a conversation with your president that you ought not have. And so, for me, quickly coming into alignment with Brian on operational things to get them out of our conversation, in other words, dispatch with them effectively, but move on to now dreaming about and talking about and imagining what kind of service provision that we can expand for our faculty, which is really why we're there. And so, when you come into a new organization, you're going to have issues with operations, and they're going to take time, and you have to focus on them. But for me and for Brian, the priority really is focusing on the next incremental opportunity to serve the faculty in ways that will surprise and please them. And that takes work. and it takes focus and concentration and face time. And you have to dedicate yourself to that.
Okay. Lynn?
I would have to agree with Rob when he's talking about doing things and making sure that you're in alignment with who you're serving. We always have to keep in mind that the end product of what we are working on is bettering the life of our faculty and our students and to some degree the staff who are around to support them. And if you get misaligned on that, i.e. your own goal of getting something done is greater than what the goal is in providing those resources to those individuals, I think is very problematic. And you see that when you start out on a project and somebody's got a whiz-bang deal that they want included in on it, and you get distracted from that. And I think keeping the main mission and the focus on the mission is the most important part of it.
Tim?
Yeah, I would add to that that there's the charge to optimize resources across the entire organization. And that all gets to, back to funneling those resources back to the mission core of the place, the academics and the research, and in our case, the patient care. Tracy has demonstrated over and over again a dedication to that. And it's visible throughout the entire enterprise that IT is not about empire building, but IT is about optimizing. And so they provide better support year in, year out for our faculty and students and staff, but they do it at a lower and lower cost. And those of us who are watching those resources and are concerned every day with the direction of our resourcing, I think everybody appreciates that and recognizes it and therefore holds IT with a very high level of trust that when they come with a proposal, they're doing it with the best interests of Duke in mind rather than their own sort of siloed best interests. And I think we've demonstrated the same within finance, frankly, and the entire administration has, for at least the last 5 years since the pressures really started to rise, have had that shared mindset that we've got to find a way to propel our missions forward, and part of that is minimizing the cost of the administration.
So you actually open a thread that wasn't part of our original discussion, so I'm going to go off script here. Not that there was a real script, but run down this rabbit hole a little bit, which is the cost of administration. And within EDUCAUSE right now, as part of the admin IT discussions, we're examining, you know, this high cost of systems. And so here we are in this time of crisis where you've got disruptive events affecting the academy on teaching and learning. You've got disruptive events in funding models in terms of continued reduction for states and even for private universities in terms of what the economic downturn did to your endowments. But with that, the political pressure and disharmony about the cost of higher ed, how long it takes to get a degree, and the amount of debt their students are carrying. So this is all leading to we've got to do a better job of how we're spending money. And one area that seems, if not ripe, at least an area to look at, is these administrative function sort of things. And so we've had this discourse already about, is it the model, you know, is it because we're spending money with a vendor, a guy who owns an island, you know, or shouldn't we be doing something collective? But one of the issues I guess I want you guys to comment on is what we've termed sort of the snowflake issue, where everyone feels that their systems, their administrative systems, have to be so perfectly customized to their environment because that is a big differentiator. So if I could just ask you to tease away at that a little bit, what's your thoughts about how we can find ways to cut the cost of administrative IT in order to free that money, if not to go into, you know, the teaching and learning or the research sides, even plowing back into our data analytics, you know, the fact that we spend a lot of money on transaction processing systems, but then don't have a lot left over for business intelligence tools and reporting and things like that. So I've been rambling to give you guys time to work up an answer. So, Tim, since your head's been nodding pretty vigorously, I'm going to ask you to start with some comments.
Sure. We have this conversation all the time, so it's a fairly straightforward one for me to answer. We know that the systems, the technologies, are a key enabler of the changes we want to see made throughout our administrative structures in the years ahead. We know business process evaluation is an ongoing thing. It will never end. And we're dedicated to continuous improvement in our business processes in ways that will streamline them, make them more efficient and more effective. And then the third piece, which is by far the most challenging is actually the people aspect of it. So we know that as you put in new sophisticated technologies, the workforce of the past will no longer have a comfortable home in a place like Duke. So as we enhance the sophistication of our business processes and we enhance the technologies we have in place, we know we have a huge human resources issue in front of us to get a workforce in place that can manage these tools and continue us down the path of continuous improvement in the years ahead. That's a really messy subject and one probably worthy of a 3 or 4 hour presentation, not a 15-minute discourse. But underlying all of it, I mean, technology is an important element of that strategy, and it obviously drives to a series of more challenging issues for us as an institution.
Yeah. Lynn?
So from my perspective on this, I think the area that needs the most examination is when we use that term business process analysis. I think when we as individuals go through that or our staff members go through it, we're doing it with the mindset of how do I make this work so it does exactly what it does today? It repeats that tomorrow when we move into a new system. I think there's a tremendous amount of resistance to get outside of that box and really take a look at the system that you are looking at implementing and figuring out how you can make your business process work within that. Because if you can't, then we're in the world of constantly making modifications and filling gaps with things that when new versions of software come out, you've got to reload those things back in. I have to admit, at CSU, we are a Qualy school. We went that direction because we felt that was one way that we could keep more money in our mission. But as we did the gap analysis, we found gaps between what Qualy brought to the table and how our current functions worked. What did we do? We built those functions with a new third-party vendor, not a new third-party vendor, but with one of our commercial affiliates to fill that gap. Well, our saving grace on that is that that will eventually become base code. But when I look back on that experience, I think, shame on us. We should have figured out, because there were really intelligent individuals who built that system to begin with, we should have figured out how we could have accomplished the same thing with the system that existed instead of building in that gap piece that we now have to load up every time we do a new version until that becomes base code. So from my perspective, I think that's the place that we have a lot of work to do in just examining ourselves and how we approach that and really trying to figure out how we use the system as it exists instead of doing our one-off snowflake modifications.
Mm-hmm. Business process reengineering is always challenging for organizations, and it's an exhausting thing to undertake. And it takes an evolution of a workforce to come to a place where continuous improvement is real as opposed to words on a page. And so that business process reengineering and continually looking at your activities in an open-minded, light way isn't exhausting, and instead it's invigorating. It's very hard, and it's a long path to get from exhausting to invigorating. But the only way that it can happen, in my view, is when there is a very strong relationship among the vice presidents, and specifically among or between the CIO and the CFO, so that the resistance that Lynn has spoken about is identified early in your organizations, and you can develop a strategy with your colleague to think about how to reduce that friction coefficient, reduce that resistance so that you can move forward. That it becomes so much more important to have a strong relationship if you're going to undertake these kinds of projects.
Well, and in fact, what you all three have just described is one of the challenges that we've been discussing in the admin IT space, which is, you know, we can't carry this water. I mean, you know, the technologists can't do it. We really need the functional area partners, and you three are examples of that. This may not be your first EDUCAUSE rodeo, but it's not a traditional stop for you guys. You all have an organization called Nakubo, and nodding heads, so I'm sure that you all are engaged. And EDUCAUSE and Nakubo at the association level have been starting to figure out how to work together. What's your view of when you go to Nakubo conferences, how that issue we just discussed, that snowflakeness, how that's starting to be discussed in your particular area? Rob?
I think it's been discussed for a lot of years that I've I've been going to conferences and engaging with colleagues. It would be unfair to characterize it completely in this way, but I think that historically, business officers at universities and in the sessions at Nakubo that address these issues have looked at IT expenses as expenses, not as investments. And more recently, in the last few years, I think people have changed the lexicon a bit to come to understand about the investment nature of information technology and the value to the academy beyond administrative services, but including administrative services. But I think there's still a way to go in the education process. And Nakubo, as an organization like EDUCAUSE, is focused on education and professional development of business officers. I think we need to have more interaction between EDUCAUSE and Nakubo in providing sessions of information where we do what we're doing here, but we do it through the various levels of the organization. There is some of that in Nakubo, but it could be expanded.
Yeah, I remember a session that Nakubo held, one of their annual meetings, where they actually did it with the facilities folks, the CUPA folks. And what I was thinking of as you were describing the synergies between the groups is, what if these two actually got together and did a session, an annual session together,
right,
where you brought a critical mass of resources on both sides of this discussion together to think about the direction that we've all decided is the right direction. And we're all dealing with it on our individual campuses, but what if we brought the industry together in that way? It'd be a really powerful environment, I think, for everybody to think forward a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you guys should send separate notes to John Walda and let him know from that perspective. Because I think, you've described this very well in terms of we have to work together, and I do feel the starting of the closing of ranks, even though we still don't have the great relationships and they need to develop. But there's more insight here. I'm not quite sure if I had put out that same note for relationships with registrars, if it would have been crickets. And we need to improve that as well. So Tim, you mentioned the thought of a ongoing dialogue or discussion. I mean, do you think that this is something between EDUCAUSE and Nakubo that they should spend more time trying to, if not integrate, at least start to build some good demilitarized zone that could have to start having conversations of this nature?
I think it's a no-brainer, particularly given the context that you said at the very beginning, where most universities didn't feel as if there was a strong relationship at the top of these organizations. That's a very troubling sign.
Right.
My sense is the industry as a whole better get that together if we really want to get where we think we want to go.
Yeah.
And I think everybody recognizes the pressing need to optimize their financial resources now, given all the pressures upon higher education, both political and real. And I think I think we've got to get more universities tuned into the vision of where we want to go, because I think it's the minority of the universities that do have this plan now in place.
Right.
And we've got to find a way to rally the industry as a whole, because the industry as a whole is at risk at the moment.
Right. Lindy, you want to add anything?
I would. So I have to admit, this is the first EDUCAUSE conference that I've been to, and I've been to several Nakubo conferences. There was a stark realization for me yesterday when I was sitting in my second session going, wow, we are really siloed. We have EDUCAUSE and all of our CIOs come here. We go to Nakubo, and it's all the financial officers. And then if you even take that picture even more broad, you've got your financial aid conferences, and then you've got your enrollment conferences. And I'm going to gather that the vendors that are downstairs in the room go to every single one of those conferences, and each of us pick up different information as we're going through there. And yet we have yet to pull together as a leadership organization and talk about it at the utmost highest levels in order to determine what makes the most sense for us as an industry to cut across all lines instead of staying within our silos. So I think it's time for that discussion, especially when we're talking about our admin IT being expensive and trying to find ways in order to do it more efficiently and more cost effective.
One final thing before we go to some questions, and that is another discussion that we've had involving this space is we can work to build these partnerships, and we should between the functional areas and IT. But the discussion of role of the guerrilla attack of actually taking more of these issues to boards and to presidents to get them involved. And of course, that's always a two-edged sword, right? Be careful what you ask for. But boards seem to be now becoming more interested in the role of IT as it affects all these areas. Whereas before, you know, there was a finance committee on a board or a capital, you know, facilities committee, and now you're starting to see that since so much of everything is related to, has an IT component, that there's an interest there. Have you all sensed that in terms of your interactions with the boards, that this is starting to happen more?
Yeah, I have, and I would suggest that there might be two drivers. Historically, the driver of board interest has been expense, right? When once you go up an order of magnitude from 1 million to 10 million, and then 10 million beyond, that gets a board's attention. But usually not in the way that you want it to. But look at what's happening in the greater society and with our children. Much more technology, variety, and availability. It's ubiquitous in our society. And our boards are out there in society, right? So they're experiencing a renaissance or a growth spurt in their own personal lives as they interact with technologies that are popping up constantly. And they recognize, because we and our presidents especially are telling them, and our provosts are telling them, how we're bringing technology into the classrooms, into the learning environment, in and creating opportunities to link scholarship and learning and the student experience in new ways with these technologies. So they're getting bombarded with these messages, and they need clear and concise explanations of the value of the investment so that they can understand it.
So I think we're about ready for some questions. I think that's where we are. My handy-dandy wristwatch is on board. So if you have a question, would you please approach the microphone, which is there since the session is being live cast, and direct your question to one of the panelists? Any questions here? How about online? If you have online questions, you can certainly drop those in as well. So I'm staring around the room. Going to have to call on somebody. Okay. All right, well, let me then just let you each take... Oh, is there someone that's got a question? Oh, Barry Walsh, would you please go up to the microphone, if you would, and thanks. The lights are blinding. This show business stuff is for the birds.
I was struck by the fact that you sent out, I think you sent it out to 60 colleagues and got two responses. I mean, is there any further insight into why that was just two, or...
I think that it's because that these relationships are rare. Well, there were a couple of factors that delve into that. One was, if you look at reporting relationships of IT organizations and CIOs, that they do vary. And it's not quite a third, but you see cases where CIOs report to the president, CIOs report to the provost, and CIOs report to the CFO based on that institution. And I sort of said, if you report to the CFO, you know, well, of course you get along with your CFO. We're not going to go there. So I was really looking for more of the peer kind of relationship situation. So I think that explains at least why a third of those 60-some people didn't respond. But my take from some of the offline comments I got back was that there weren't good relationships. I certainly had instances in my past, and I won't... you know, name names, but there were places where I sort of felt, you know, subservient, right? So I had to go on bended knee and ask for money from the CFO, and if it was something the CFO thought was important, great, I got money. If they didn't think it was important, they themselves, you know, get out of here, go do something else. So I think that's sort of the breakdown here. I really do think that this is an uncommon set here. I just don't know of a lot of colleagues that have... not just a good working relationships, but friendships with their colleagues. Another question.
We talk a lot in the CIO community about the change in role of the CIO due to the change in academy, external pressures, technology changes. And I'm wondering if you could share with us how the CFO role is changing.
That's an excellent question. So who wants to step forward and field that first?
Well, I guess I'll take the risk. It is changing, and I don't have a sense of all of the complete nature of that. There is a growing expectation that the responsibilities and the thinking of the CFO that has characterized private sector organizations outside of higher education for decades and decades, where the CFO is a key strategic partner to the president and CEO of a corporation. It's only recently, in recent years, I think, that higher education on a broad scale is recognizing the need to hire truly strategic CFO talent. And I think in the development of business officers as they rise in the organizations to the level of CFO, we have, I think, we could do a bit of a better job in preparing the next generation of CFOs to be much more strategic. There are words like entrepreneurial that are used, but no one really knows exactly what that means because it usually means the opposite of risk averse, which is associated with a CFO. But careful risk taking to strategically move the institution forward is a skill set that must be learned, and that is, I think, one area that's changing in the realm of the CFO.
I think we've also all observed a migration of talent acquisition for the CFO roles to be more industry-focused, more corporately focused than just higher education focused. More and more you'll see the big-name universities pulling their new CFOs from industry. And I think there's a reason for that, and that is that the boards expect a more business-like approach to the way these universities are run. And we're all huge organizations. Duke's got $4.5 billion of revenue in a year. That needs to be attended to in a professional way that the board can feel comfortable that we are exercising their fiduciary responsibilities the right way. So we're all dealing with that. I think the best-in-breed approach, though, is if you can find individuals for the CFO role who have a corporate mindset but also a good bit of higher education experience and some familiarity with the peculiarities of higher education. Because these corporate folks that come into higher education and the learning curve they must experience and then endure is staggering. You know, God bless them for trying to dive into this abyss and figure it all out with a corporate mindset.
We certainly have that in common between our two professions. I mean, yeah. I think our colleagues that have come from the private sector in the IT realms also have those same sort of challenges. Lynn, did you want to add something?
Certainly. From my perspective, one of the biggest changes that we're seeing in the CFO role, particularly in state-funded institutions, is the mix of our revenue. We are losing state funding. We are no longer as concerned about what the state legislature is running through as new statutory requirements. We're more interested in going out and trying to find out how we can find ways of generating new revenue. And so our focus has been away from the state and more on independence on the things that we can be doing to generate those revenues and help our colleagues find ways to do that and then figure out how we can do it within the constraints of a semi-public institution and stay within the laws and regulations that we have to work within.
Okay, great. Other questions? Anyone? Anyone from online? Okay, I got a nod, so someone is working their way over to the microphone now.
Are there any regulatory requirements that you would like your CIOs to become more familiar with from your world?
Well, the answer obviously is yes. We would love our CIOs to be omniscient and therefore see these things coming the same way we do. But I think there's a balance there, and the CIOs have their own plates full, and we have a lot of people on the financial and administrative side who are charged with understanding the regulatory environment and creating solutions to that in partnership with IT leaders and others. So I don't think it's necessarily a need for the CIO to understand all of it or even to spend a larger share of their time worried about the regulatory environment. I just think they need to remain actively engaged and realistic about the way those regulatory changes will determine priorities in some cases. The best example of that is in the research environment, the way the federal government and their regulatory bodies have behaved over the last 10 years is almost embarrassing, and we've been forced to accommodate that. And IT has got to play a role in it, and they continue to do so every day. But that doesn't mean that the CIO's got to spend their time familiarizing, in our case, herself with that. We have people who grapple with those issues every day. We bring them to her attention, and the key is that Tracy has the relationships in place to engage in those discussions, understand the priorities as they are articulated by the people who are more knowledgeable of them, and then deal with them and help us address them.
Yes.
To the whole panel, the issue of the commercial players on both the CBO and the IT side, it really just struck me what you all were saying there. I are a recovering MBA in investment banking, and I like to think that my colleagues in finance that I've known, I worked in finance a long time, are data-driven people for the most part. I think IT people are pretty much data-driven people. But yet what I'm hearing you all say is that we've had this series of, in many cases, catastrophic outcomes when a private sector CBO came in to higher ed or a private sector CIO came in. There has to be data behind that, and I hate to put you on the spot, my good colleague Brian, but you know, what if EDUCAUSE needs to find a way to get through to the John Waldo organization of trustees to stop doing the, well, that didn't work, let's try it again.
Right.
And continue to push private sector people into this milieu that they're frankly not qualified to work in. I mean, you and I came from 15 years in the private sector before I joined the university. It took me a long time to adjust, and it was really, really difficult. If I had been thrust into a serious leadership role at that point in time, I would probably have screwed up badly by just not knowing the environment. I mean, how can you kind of stop this repetition of what sounds like not a lot of success stories?
Well, so I'm gonna lead in, let you have one more minute to think about this, because in the IT profession, one of the things that we really are seeing more and more and having, I guess, the chutzpah to come out and say is that the people who hire us don't have a clue as to what it is that we do. And so as a result, they're using all sorts of different non-data-driven metrics. And usually the most common one is, we want someone who looks 180 degrees different than the person that we just had. And that's a problem. And a recruiter recently said that, you know, what they're seeing is, and if they do have an idea of what they want, it's based on a 1995-1999 image of what the IT person is about, as opposed to someone more strategically. So how does that relate from our profession? We're seeing, you know, they don't know what they're doing when they're hiring us. How does that relate to what you guys see on your side?
Well, I'd add to it the board. So the boards, it's not just the president who may be hiring us, or the provost, or this, or the executive vice president, but in our case, it's the board. So the board comes with a corporate perspective for the most part. At least in the private university space, the boards are very corporately minded. And so they see people from their everyday experience, and they think, boy, if that person could just get into X university, they could really run that place much better. So they bring in that corporate mentality, and they want to see it in place. And then they see the implications of it, you know, a couple years later.
Yeah.
And I think it's very hard to get away from that corporate bias among the boards.
But I think we also... Despite the data. Well, I want to take issue with the data that we're referring to that may not exist, except in our imagination.
Experience.
We're really talking about empirical or experience, as opposed to someone has actually done the surveys, because I've not seen them if they have been done. I don't want to leave the impression that people from the corporate sector coming into higher education are destined to fail and to mess up our universities. I don't believe that. And in fact, I simply believe that they are. It is rare to find people from the corporate environment who also have either the actual experience in higher education institutions or the evidence of adaptability to succeed in the environment that we work in. Now, they exist. I think we need to figure out a pipeline and a mechanism to juice that pipeline in order to create more of those people and more of those opportunities to hire those people. Recently, I hired at Maryland the former senior vice president of Newsweek. He's superb. He came to us from Columbia University, where he worked for 3 years in the finance organization and got his feet wet in higher education administration. So if we that's anecdotal, but what I'm interested in is identifying an actual mechanism by which we can create a pipeline that will serve our industry better in the long run.
Well, and as you say that, I mean, that we have the same pipeline development issues too, so it's very interesting that a different discipline has it. But I'm sorry, Lynn.
No, that's okay. You know, maybe what it is it's the onus upon us working with our professional organizations such as EDUCAUSE and Nukubo to develop a pathway for individuals that are brought in from industry to work in training them about the nuances of higher education. We have to face it. We are so different in how we operate than the private industry. Our revenue sources, the way we look at our IT resources that we deploy in the university, we look at them so differently than what private industry does, that probably is going to be one of the more successful ways that we could make that transition for those individuals coming into this industry.
We've seen, I guess, the two words that define the difference is shared governance. And industry people don't have that. I mean, there isn't like the employees of the corporation are part of the decision-making process. It's very down. But in our world, you know, you've got faculty senates or university senates, student government and things like that, that are more than just chat rooms that, you know, they take shared governance very serious, and I think that certainly affects the technology role because of the teaching and learning research, but obviously affects the financial role as well because you guys just can't exist in the administration building. You have to go out and deal with deans and faculty and others. So, all right, well, I think we are nearing the end. I just wanted to give the panelists one more, you know, 30-second shot each if there's any parting comments that you would like to make to the CIOs. And you know, Tracy and Pat and I will certainly protect you so that you can get out of the room in case there's anything inflammatory you'd like to say. So, Lynn, let me start with you.
I would just like to say thank you to Pat. Thank you for being my partner in crime and my support in when we have to go forward with some difficult choices and present those to those who are going to be making decisions. So thank you, Pat.
Tim?
I'd encourage everybody in the room, if you are part of one of those relationships, which Brian was referring to at the beginning, where it may not be exactly where you want it to be, that you make a commitment to establish some sort of communication structure where you can better understand the priorities of the CFO and help him or her understand your priorities. Because if you don't understand each other, it's just not going to work. And if you're not communicating, you're not going to understand each other. So anything you can do to create the environment where you will have a shared vision will be very helpful to your institution. And I think the more that can happen, it'll be better for the industry as a whole.
And Rob?
And I would add that we're the natural people on your campuses to try to experiment in explaining the importance of what you do. We're the most likely to understand if you make the effort, right? Our presidents, God bless them all, are out raising money and are not focused on the IT mission. And you need all the advocacy that you can get. And so start with the natural ally, which I believe should be your CFO. And it takes work to do that, but it's worth it. And just in conclusion, thank you, my friend, for inviting us to participate and to speak with you today. It's a pleasure.
Well, as I said in the opening, purr there, pal. Thank you all for coming today. Thank you. Be sure to fill out your evaluations. Great.